I next met with Dr. Jeffrey Sossman, and to begin, we picked up on the adjuvant discussion with Dr. Pavlik and chatted about new ongoing trials looking at the plethora of new agents in melanoma in the adjuvant setting, beginning with ipilimumab.
I'm very much in favor and encouraged by the concept, but it is just a concept. And the feeling is that patients with more intact immune system and smaller volume of disease would respond better to the ipilimumab. While the ipilimumab causes shrinkage of tumor in a small percentage of patients, 5 to 15%, we all believe that there's a larger group of patients who benefit. And when I say benefit, have stable disease for 6 to 12 months or more. And so I think probably the number who benefit like that is probably more in the range of 30 to 40%. So the hope is that the impact on the adjuvant setting will be even greater. And if you use the animal models for whatever they are worth, you know, certainly the outcome is better with smaller volume.
So what other strategies are being looked at in the adjuvant setting? And obviously the issue of BRAF inhibitors and BRAF mutant tumors comes up.
Right, and that is the other strategy. And that involves, there's two trials that I'm aware of. One right now involves the vemurafenib, the approved drug, a BRAF inhibitor, and that's being compared to placebo in, again, a high-risk group of patients. And the other is a combination of a BRAF inhibitor, dabrafenib, plus a MEK inhibitor, trametinib. I think both those trials are important, but I certainly have concern about the single-agent BRAF inhibitor and its potential to be associated with acceleration of secondary cancers. And the squamous cell cancers we know about, but certainly now we're talking about a much lower risk group of patients, not metastatic patients. And we don't know whether other malignancies could be triggered as well, or at least they wouldn't be induced, but they would be accelerated by the drug.
Any particular second cancer that you're concerned about?
Well, so far we have some evidence for a few things. I think the strongest evidence is secondary melanomas. We have seen some. There has also been what appears to be a high number of patients with adenomatous polyps, though I would take that result with great caution because these were not all followed before, and so the colonoscopy may have been abnormal even before treatment. And the other evidence we have is from a New England Journal article where the patient had a chronic leukemia with an NRAS mutation, and that leukemia was there when the treatment was started, but it certainly accelerated with the vemurafenib. And I think all of us are worried about those malignancies that may have a RAS mutation or some other abnormality that activates that same pathway, the MAP kinase pathway.
It's interesting, though, you mentioned about the second melanoma. Is that something that, you know, a lot of people are concerned about or just something you yourself have noticed? Do we have much data on that?
There's some data. I personally have not seen it, but there are some collection series of patients that have a fairly high incidence. It's nowhere the incidence that we see for squamous cell cancers, but I think it's high enough, and we know at this point that none of those tested have a BRAF mutation. So that is consistent with what you would expect with the BRAF inhibitor. And I think it's cautionary and it's important for follow-up and, you know, really maintenance of skin exams being so important in this group of patients.
And as long as we brought up that question, I'm just kind of curious, this relates to the metastatic disease, but also particularly in the adjuvant setting. Right now, if you think about the propensity to cause second squamous cell cancers of the skin, how would you compare vemurafenib to dabrafenib to the combination of dabrafenib and trametinib?
Well, I do not believe there is a big difference between vemurafenib and dabrafenib in terms of secondary squamous cell cancers. The dabrafenib does have a characteristic that makes it a little more attractive, and that's the photosensitivity that you see with vemurafenib can be quite severe. In terms of the combination of a BRAF inhibitor and a MEK inhibitor, there's no doubt in my mind that there are less squamous cells, significantly less. And I think we'll see that when Roche also comes out with their combination in their smaller series of patients who received their combination, they saw a very low rate of secondary squamous cell cancers. So I think overall, either set of drugs are better in terms of secondary malignancies.
So let's talk about kind of your clinical algorithm outside of a trial setting. I'm sure your first priority is to try to look at what trials might be available. But assuming you're outside the protocol setting, can you talk a little bit about, maybe we can start out with BRAF wild type in terms of how you think through initial and second therapy?
Yeah. I think the BRAF wild type patients, certainly we have some standard algorithm. For us at the center we're at, if they're extremely healthy, if they have good organ function, if their disease is not wildly aggressive, and they're under 65 or under 70, we still give high-dose interleukin-2. That is still our standard approach to those patients. And we do that because we believe and we know there is a small but real cure rate. And that's why we give it for those 5 to 10% of patients.
Anything new in terms of predictors of benefit to high-dose IL-2? I saw some stuff related to mutations, including NRAS, and wonder what you thought about that.
Yeah. Well, we're very interested in the whole question of NRAS mutations and responsiveness to immune therapy. And I think there's more data, hopefully, that will be presented. I don't know if it's going to link just to interleukin-2. Hopefully, it'll also link or may link to some of the other immune agents. But I would say that at this point, certainly having an NRAS mutation doesn't mean you're going to respond, and the lack of it certainly doesn't mean that you're not going to respond. But it is a clue. We're just finishing up a trial where we're trying to analyze a whole bunch of questions. We've treated about 160 patients with metastatic disease, and we're just collecting blood and tissue on all of them. And we're going to look at both host and tumor-related factors, and certainly mutations will be one of those factors that we'll look at, as well as gene expression. So I would say the short answer is nothing ready for prime time.
So I'm going to guess that in the patients who don't respond to high-dose IL-2, you then consider IPI?
Right. The second reason we don't go to ipilimumab first is a concern that we have that there could be a late toxicity to the ipilimumab that would manifest itself while they're getting the interleukin-2 or around that time. And with interleukin-2, you're dealing with enough toxicity as is. And the diarrhea, the liver problems, the rash, all of those usually occur earlier, but can occur later. And our own feeling is that the order of IL-2 followed by ipilimumab may make more sense. The other reason we do that is because we usually can get a readout. we can determine whether they're responding to interleukin 2 by around 7-8 weeks. And if they're progressing at 8 weeks, there is no reason to wait a lot longer. While, as you know, on the other hand, sometimes it takes quite a while to see the full benefit of ipilimumab. And there are patients at 12 weeks who are progressing, who then at 20 weeks begin to shrink their tumor and regress. So I think all of those are factors in how we decide.
And in terms of the high-dose IL-2, at what point will you consider stable disease essentially a failure and go on to something else like ipi?
I don't consider stable disease as a success with high-dose interleukin-2. So I certainly, in my practice, if they are stable, I do not give them more interleukin-2 therapy. On the other hand, if they are truly stable, I don't start ipilimumab either. I will watch them very closely, and the great majority will begin to show progression of their disease. And at that time, I will start ipilimumab, but not while they still have completely stable disease.
So I want to talk a little bit about BRAF mutant disease, but first, just to kind of keep it straightforward, in terms of ipi, can you kind of provide a capsule in terms of what we know and what you've actually seen in your own practice in terms of the time course for the typical development of complications and what specifically you see?
I think in general, we're talking about the metastatic patient. I'm not going to go into detail about the adjuvant patient because I think the time course may be different. But in the metastatic setting, it's extremely rare to see major toxicity after the first dose. It usually begins to occur much more after the second or more likely after the third dose. So I would say at week 7 to week 10 is a very high point to see toxicity, and many of those patients will manifest at that time. Most patients will manifest within the first 12 weeks. And even though I mentioned that we had concern about late toxicity, and we've seen it, we usually see some sign of toxicity early on. We've seen a few things that have been fairly significant and some more common than we would have expected. Many patients get rash, and most of those patients, it's very manageable and tolerable with a fair amount of pruritus, but certainly not a severe full body rash.
What's the typical distribution, and does it remind you of some other kind of rash?
Well, it does in some cases look very typical of a drug reaction rash, macular papular, usually papular, and when it coalesces, we certainly get much more concern. But there are a lot of patients who manifest very little rash, just a lot of pruritus, and what you see is more a reaction to the itching and scratching than you do a real rash.
How do you manage the rash, and at what point do you use corticosteroids?
Well, we rarely use corticosteroids systemically. We may use corticosteroids locally in some areas. We certainly use a lot of antihistamines, both antihistamines and even cimetidine and ranitidine, type 2 antihistamines. And we use creams as well. Benadryl creams and other creams can be helpful.
Does this tend to continue after you stop treatment?
The rash usually begins to fade away. It certainly is, again, worse after the second. You might see some of the real pruritus early on, even before the second dose. In terms of other toxicities, I think everybody is aware of the colon toxicity, the colitis, and we have a very low threshold for bringing people in. I try, at all, if it's practical, to do colonoscopies on these patients. And it isn't because I think I have to have it to make a diagnosis. I think, you know, before I start exposing them or while I'm exposing them to high-dose corticosteroids, parenterally and then orally, it's really reassuring that we know what we're treating. And certainly there are some people who, since we do start treatment early, who don't have inflammatory colitis. And if that diagnosis is made on a colonoscopy, that it's clear, then you can avoid all those steroids. But we start patients early. If they have a few days or explosive diarrhea, then we'll bring them in very quickly. And usually, if they're sick enough, we'll admit them for IV, intravenous steroids, and a colonoscopy.
Any other side effects you want to comment on, including
I think endocrine? Other is really what you just said, is the endocrine. We see a lot of that, and we certainly see a lot of thyroiditis manifesting itself with low thyroid function and some adrenalitis with low cortisol. But the most troubling and the one we see frequently is hypophysitis. And so I think everyone needs to be very aware of that side effect. And we manage our patients looking at cortisol levels and TSH and thyroid functions with each dose. So every 3 weeks we will look at it. And sometimes we pick it up before the patient complains of symptoms and sometimes after. But it certainly can be a major cause of severe fatigue. And you need to watch for it because many of the patients can get fatigued to some degree from the ipilimumab alone. But you want to make sure you're not missing the hypophysitis and the panhypopituitarism.
So let's talk a little bit about management of patients with metastatic BRAF mutant disease. And I guess where I see quite a bit of controversy is the patient with low volume, asymptomatic metastatic disease. It seems like it's pretty straightforward that if people have symptoms or bulk, they're going to get a BRAF inhibitor, remurafenib for the time being. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely correct.
So in those other groups of patients, I don't know how often, you know, what fraction of people are asymptomatic with low volume, but how do you think through their algorithm?
Well, obviously, I don't want to keep repeating myself, but certainly if we have clinical trials on both sides, we will tend to move in that direction. If a patient is truly asymptomatic, they have low volume disease, they have a normal LDH, generally don't have liver metastases, we probably would consider first immune therapy. And I would go through the same sequence of interleukin-2 and ipilimumab. But it's not that easy to predict which of those low-volume disease will change abruptly. And I think you have to be prepared for that. And I do look for clues that may suggest that this is a patient in transition. And if so, I would possibly favor the BRAF inhibitor. But I think that giving them the option of an immune treatment makes sense. Now, the initial data and the data that we saw is that some patients on BRAF inhibitor have very long progression-free survival and long survival. Those are the patients who have low-volume disease. So you're also not necessarily taking that into consideration. But probably the most important factor that has swayed me is that I've seen a number of people get BRAF inhibitor therapy, fail that therapy, and then their disease appears to be accelerated. And many of those patients do not even receive a full round of immune therapy. So that's one of my major concerns, is that if I start with a BRAF inhibitor, the patient may not be able to get an immune agent after that.
What about the management of patients with brain mets and BRAF mutant tumors? Are there situations where you'll treat with a BRAF inhibitor like vemurafenib and hold off on local treatment like radiation?
Yeah, definitely there are situations like that. If it's a really small tumor, I will hold off. It's a little hard to hold off if there's only one or two isolated lesions that are small, and to not do stereotactic radiosurgery because it's so easy to do both. But I certainly wouldn't believe that it's unreasonable to hold off and start with the BRAF inhibitor, watch closely both the systemic disease in the brain, and if the brain begins to grow and stays isolated, then to treat it at that time.
Any comments on the combination of vemurafenib and ipilimumab? I saw a letter to the New England Journal about a study that had to be stopped.
Tony Rebus was the first author, and they were not able to combine the two, giving them both together. They first gave the vemurafenib for a period of time, several weeks, and then started the ipilimumab. And the limiting factor was hepatitis. And they were requiring to go down to 1 milligram of ipilimumab, and nobody's very comfortable with that kind of dose reduction.
So the last thing I want to ask you about is anti-PD-1. Can you talk a little bit about what it is, what we know about it in general, and what we know about it in melanoma?
Okay, so anti-PD-1 is another antibody that binds to another checkpoint molecule on T lymphocytes. And there's some differences between it and ipilimumab, which binds to CTLA-4. First, the PD-1 is a marker that comes on later on the T cell. It's not an early marker that's engaged right after activation. So we talk about it as a marker on exhausted T cells. So it affects it at a later time point. The other factor that's important is the ligand PD-L1 is expressed by tumor cells. So it definitely blocks this late effect that is due to an interaction between tumor cells and T cells.
Could I just pick up on that one point? What do we know right now about the predictive ability of PD-L1 in terms of benefit from anti-PD-1?
You know, the initial New England Journal article suggested that if you did not have the PD-L1 marker on your tumor cells, you would not respond, so that it was a discriminating marker and you could select patients. I believe subsequent studies have and will show that this is not true. It's absolutely true that if you have the PD-L1 marker on your tumor cells, you're more likely to respond. But if you don't have it, it's certainly still feasible for you to respond at some rate. So whether it's a doubling or even less improvement, it is a factor, and it likely makes a difference, but it's not the test that we want to really screen our patients and only treat those with PD-L1 expression. That, I do not believe, is going to be a clear message.
What do we know globally in terms of efficacy with anti-PD-1 in melanoma?
What we know so far is primarily from two clinical trials, two large phase 1 trials with large extension cohorts. And the first is called nivolumab, and that shows about a 30% response rate, and it's pretty robust. That's in 100 patients or so. And it appears that the response duration is going to be well past the year and approaching 2 years. And few of those patients have relapsed who've had a response. And many of them have completed the 2 years of treatment.
Have you used the drug yourself?
Absolutely. We've been involved in several trials. The initial phase one trial, we were heavily involved, and we've been involved in other trials as well. The other drug that's shown a lot of activity is MK-3475, and it has a name for certain, but I have trouble pronouncing it. And that drug has shown a very high response rate initially, but has very short follow-up. I believe both at ASCO and in publication we'll learn much more about it, but I would say it certainly looks very promising as well. The nice thing about the data we have from that drug is that it definitely has an almost equally good response rate in failures of ipilimumab or patients who progress. And so that certainly is promising that we could use one drug and then switch to the other and get a benefit.
I know it's kind of hard to compare indirectly, but it kind of seems like, just sort of looking at it, that maybe anti-PD-1 as a strategy has less complications and toxicity than IPI?
Yes, I think overall it does. It has much less fatigue. It does have some rash. The gastrointestinal and hepatobiliary toxicity is much less. I don't know if we've seen any cases of panhypopituitarism. We have seen some hypothyroidism. The one area that is of concern, though it's infrequent, is pneumonitis. And that's probably the one manifestation that you need to be really aware of and vigilant about, following oxygen levels and cough and shortness of breath in your patients to really be sure that they're not developing a pneumonitis. So I think overall, absolutely, it appears less toxic, and the response rate is significantly higher.
I'm just kind of curious, having used the drug, I'm sure you could tell me about some patients who you could look at and say the patient definitely benefited. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely.
So, because certainly every investigator I've talked to who've been involved with these trials have said that. And maybe just kind of as a closing comment, I'm just kind of curious what your global view is in terms of when drugs like this, new encouraging agents, should be brought on the market. I'm going to guess there are a bunch of patients in your practice that you'd like to treat with this drug. You're looking for trials to see if you can get them on this. I mean, do you think this level of evidence kind of justifies having a drug like this available?
Yeah, that's a really hard question. I think we may, by pushing that, and certainly the AIDS HIV group did a great job getting drugs quickly, but in cancer, it's not all that easy to get patients on clinical trials. And if we do too much of that, we'll never finish the trials that have to be done to really establish the degree of benefit, which is very hard to establish in a phase two study. I do believe, though, with a drug like this, that crossover design should be done. And I don't agree that you won't see a benefit if you allow crossovers. And I think it's actually cruel, and I wouldn't say unethical, but unfair to your patient population to put them into a study that randomizes between PD-1 and chemotherapy and not allow them to cross over to PD-1. So that's one opinion I have. I think as soon as those phase three studies are accrued to, then they should have an expanded access program. And that's important. And that's important to get out quickly after those studies are completed. But I do still think that you do need to complete those important trials.
So just out of curiosity, because I find that, you know, docs hear about exciting agents and yet maybe not that necessarily easy to get them on a trial. right now at your own center, are you able to get patients on trials of anti-PD-1, and what kinds of trials?
Oh, I think patients will come out of the woodwork for PD-1 trials. We were very involved early in BRAF mutant trials, and certainly we saw a lot of patients. But the outcry among patients for this drug is even greater. And I've told my colleagues that if they gave me 50 slots for patients for PD-1 who haven't received it, and I had enough nurses, I could put them on in a few weeks, frankly. And so I've seen a real outcry of those. And, you know, that leaves me at an academic center in somewhat of a quandary, because I do want to finish the phase 3 studies, and I do think they're important, but I also want to have access to the newer studies, and certainly studies that are combining it with other agents, combining it with ipilimumab. Those are really exciting trials that need to be done and will attract patients as well.
So again, just to be a little bit more specific then, if someone were to send you a patient right now with the hopes of them getting on anti-PD-1, right now, do you have trials available you could put them on?
Right now, if I have a patient who has not had ipilimumab, we don't have a trial that's open. However, we're hoping to have one open within the next 4 weeks, and then subsequently, a few weeks later, even another study. So we're moving towards the upfront study. Those upfront studies are randomized studies, though, and not everybody will get PD-1. So I don't have the ability to select a patient for PD-1 who has not received anything else as a phase 2 study.
So in terms of people who have received IPI, do you have trials that a patient like that would be eligible for?
Yes, we have several trials like that. And we have a trial that allows crossover. So certainly that's a trial I can live with, and I can certainly tell my patients that you may not get PD-1 now, but if you progress on the chemotherapy, we will switch you over.